that one. That one off. Cool. Well, we're over here doing the special edition of the online dinner party with Mark Lee. So definitely glad that folks can join me on this particular show. And as always, we have amazing guests. I know that yesterday we had the gentleman that is running for governor out of Florida. And we also had a couple of disability advocates. But this time I'm very glad to have a good friend as well as a distant family member, which I found out much later on that we are related. But Sandy Darity is known to many because of his work on the concept of reparations, and also because of his discussion with his wife around the wealth disparity gap that exists and things of that nature. So that being said, Sandy, it's great to have you on here with me and everything. It's been a minute since we've seen each other because everybody is kind of locked into their homes and into their work environments and things of that nature. So unfortunately, we don't get around to seeing each other as often as we usually would. I know I haven't even seen your kids, who are great entertainers and things of that nature, because of all that is going on. And actually, later on this evening, I'm going to have to do a Zoom call with my uncle, Uncle Randy Walker, because he is actually celebrating his birthday, and his family member, my cousin Tanya, is going to have a Zoom celebration with him, because so many people are not able to make it to what would usually be a wonderful celebration at their house or something along that nature. But she's in Charlotte. She's already reached out to me. The cousin is in Georgia. Cousin is actually in Saudi Arabia, and some other cousins from around the area, so that we can actually celebrate his birthday later on today in this Zoom conversation that we're going to have in that way. So it is a new era that we're living in, but some of the same problems still exist. I know my buddy Shree talks about the fact that we're in the middle of what he considers three things that we are dealing with in the world, and particularly in the United States. He talks about the fact that we're in an economic crisis, that we're in the health crisis, which everybody knows because of the pandemic and things of that nature. But he also says that we're in the middle of what he considers a crisis in race relations and things of that nature. So I just wanted to know your take on that, and also how you're doing on today. So Sandy, it's great to have you on here, and great to have folks learn more about you and our connections, as well as just so that you can talk about some of the things that are going on and some of your thoughts, because I know you have that book that just came out, and I'm hearing great things about it. I need to get a copy of it, but I'm hearing great things about it.
Thanks. Well, Mark, first of all, thank you for having me on. It was a great revelation to discover that we were cousins, and I appreciate not only talking to you as a friend, but also as a relative. So I would say that from my perspective, the present moment is perhaps one of the most optimistic that I have experienced with respect to the prospects of the actual adoption of reparations in the United States, reparations for Black American descendants of U.S. slavery. I think that to some degree, the corner turned in the previous year, in 2019, when I think for the first time in my lifetime, presidential candidates actually mouthed the term reparations. Now, they were still, to some degree, ducking the idea of a comprehensive reparations program. And what you heard from those who were willing to endorse some dimension of the reparations project was that they were in favor of H.R. 40, which is a piece of legislation that would establish a study commission to make the case for reparations and to design proposals for restitution, but that was you know, a somewhat of a departure from whatever we had seen or witnessed before, and now with the tragedies that have occurred this year at the hands of America's police forces, it seems to be the case that there's a widespread recognition of something that was well understood in the Black community, that there is this thing that we can characterize as anti-Black police violence, and that it has a long, long trajectory in terms of producing grief and loss in the Black community. But I think that once there's been a more widespread recognition of this problem, we now have a receptiveness to a number of policies that people previously treated as outside of the bounds of being credible. And I think one of those is Black reparations for descendants of slavery in the United States.
And I know one of the things that you talked about in your research and everything else is this concept of the wealth disparity. And I know that that exists. I know I have my own wealth disparity and others have theirs. But could you talk to those that are listening about what you mean by the wealth disparity? Because I know that sometimes people don't want to accept that there's a wealth disparity or they don't want to acknowledge it. But when you talk about that, can you give us some of the figures and some of the ideas of what you mean by that wealth disparity?
I think it's important to distinguish wealth from income because I think sometimes people confuse the two. So income is primarily a flow of resources that we receive in a given amount of time. We usually think about it on an annual basis. So our annual income is the language that we usually use. And the primary source of income for most people is their earnings from employment. There are some cases where individuals might have a sufficient amount of wealth, and we'll come to this, that they can draw upon the interest that they earn off of their assets as a source of income. And there are other individuals in our community who whose incomes are so low that they may be eligible or qualify for cash transfers from the state or federal government, and that's another source of income. But for the majority of folks, the primary source of income is what they earn in the labor market. This is in contrast with wealth, which is actually a concept of the net value of our property. The difference between the value of what we own and what we owe, or the difference between our assets and our liabilities. And there are a variety of forms that property can take. It could include certain kinds of durable appliances, even a stove or a refrigerator, or it could be the family car, mm-hmm. or it could be the home that you own if you are a homeowner. It could be real estate. It could be stocks, bonds, and other types of financial assets. And so there are a variety of ways in which people can hold wealth. But to get the full concept of wealth, we have to subtract off their debts. And so that leaves us with this notion of net worth, the residual that remains after you take the difference between assets and liabilities. And that's what we're generally referring to when we talk about wealth. So why do I make that distinction? I make that distinction because the difference between wealth, between Blacks and whites, is much, much, much larger than the difference between income between Blacks and whites. So I think on average, probably Black Americans have somewhere in the vicinity of 65 to 70% of the income that white Americans have. But if we look at wealth, Black Americans have one-tenth of the wealth per household as white Americans. Another way to think about this is Black Americans constitute about 13% of the nation's population, mm-hmm. but only possess about 2.5% of the nation's wealth. That yields a condition where the average Black household has $800,000 less in net worth than the average white household. And so in the context of the work that Kirsten Mullen and I have done in our book, From Here to Equality, we focus on this wealth disparity, this huge gulf in wealth between Blacks and whites, as the object that a reparations project needs to address. And so what we argue is that reparations should do, Black reparations in the United States, what it should do is eliminate the racial wealth disparity. So it should erase that $800,000 differential between Black and white households by building Black assets to a sufficient level that Black net worth will be comparable to white net worth.
Wow. And I know that one of the problems, I guess, that existed with that as well is the loss of the black land. So the land that our farmers had and things of that nature, because that is something that we did have that would have been something that we could have exercised some of our money to. But I know that at one point in our history, there was a lot of loss of land in the African-American community. So I imagine that that is probably also adding to the fact of how low our wealth is in terms of the bigger picture.
Yeah, but even before that, there was the problem that was associated with the denial of an initial amount of allotment of land. When folks emerged from enslavement, they were promised 40 acres land grants, and those 40 acres land grants were never delivered. When General Sherman issued Special Orders Number 15 in January 1865, before the Civil War actually ended, he was designating approximately 5.3 million acres of land stretching from the Sea Islands and Charleston to northern Florida for the formerly enslaved. And unfortunately, only about 40,000 people were settled on about 400,000 acres of land. And even that was taken away from them by the end of 1865 at the orders of President Andrew Johnson, who restored all of the land to the former slaveholders. So that's the beginning of land loss, in a sense. It's land deprivation. And it occurs at the same time that the United States government is providing 160-acre land allotments to large numbers of white families in the western part of the United States on territory that had been taken from the native population. And so this process of, you know, the wagon train and white settlers moving into the west of the United States, that was all process that was dictated by the terms of the Homestead Act. But what the Homestead Act also did was it designated land for the formerly enslaved, but that land was never delivered. And so on the one hand, you have no restitution for those folks who had been subjected to slavery, and you had substantial land allotments that were given to white Americans, including those who fought for the Confederacy to preserve slavery.
Well, that's one of the things that I guess we're learning, even in kind of the movement to remove some of these Confederate statues and things of that nature, is what you just alluded to, the history that we don't often talk about people like Andrew Johnson and others that were part of this kind of going on that took our land and took our rights away from us that we should have had many years ago. But people forget that part, and they forget that part of history. And I think that that's kind of what's going on with the Black Lives Matter movement, is that we're seeing more people finding out this negative history about some people that have been immortalized as great figures in our presidential politics and things of that nature.
Yeah, I think that, one of the great tragedies of the way in which we have developed a historical memory in the United States is the fact that the Confederacy as a project has been treated as some sort of heroic act, an act of defense of states' rights and states' integrity, rather than describing it for what it really was, which was an act of traitorship. And the individuals who led the Confederacy were traitors against the nation of the United States. And unless we begin to clearly state that and clearly understand that, we will continue to be confused about the nation's history, and we will be confused about what the nation's responsibilities are to those citizens who have been denied full citizenship for 155 years.
Now, it's not one of my arguments, but I have heard the argument from friends of mine that are of the other societies and things of that nature that they shouldn't have to pay because that was their ancestors. They had nothing to do with that back then and things of that nature, as well as the fact that they will sometimes argue that some of our people in our community are already getting money through welfare and other things of that nature. What is your argument against those folks? So like I said, I definitely do not attest to that kind of theories, but I have heard those theories from others that are definitely not the fans of reparations. So what is your argument against those folks that would say that, look, that happened 100 years ago, 200 years ago, therefore I don't need to be concerned about it, and I don't need to be having my money taken to pay African-American descendants.
So I think the first thing is, I think that people presume that the financing of a reparations project would require money to be taken out of the pockets of white individuals in the United States and transferred to black individuals. The process doesn't work that way. This is not a question of individual guilt. This is a question of national responsibility, and it's the federal government that has to pay the bill. And the federal government can do that without actually raising taxes for anyone. So so it's not a question of taking from Peter to pay Paul. So that's the first misconception. The second misconception is associated with the notion that folks who are living today have no connection to the history of slavery, because it's the repercussions of slavery that are at stake. It's the fact that the process of enslavement led to the economic development of the United States, both North and South, in such a way that it made it an attractive place for folks to come as migrants on a later date. And so when you migrate to a country, you migrate to its responsibilities and you migrate to its history. But the third point I'd like to make is that this is not a situation in which the only rationale for reparations for Black American descendants of U.S. slavery is slavery itself. In our book, we talk at length about the harms and damages that are associated with the 100 years of legal segregation that followed the end of the Civil War, what we refer to as the Jim Crow period in the United States. And that period of legal segregation was accompanied by a series of white mob violence acts that destroyed a large number of black communities across the country, resulted in the destruction of black lives, the destruction of black property, and in some cases, the outright appropriation of that property by the white mobsters. And so again, we see another dimension of how the racial wealth gap was created or produced by American policy, to the extent that the federal government looked the other way while these massacres were taking place. And I would warrant that there's still a huge number of folks who are living, both black and white, who were alive during the Jim Crow years. I would count myself among those. Now, you know, if the country waits long enough, folks who are in my age group, because we're fairly old now, will no longer be around, and people can say that they're no more living victims once again. But if you have a persistent series of national acts of procrastination, that does not absolve the nation of the responsibility for meeting the debt. And now you mentioned also that people say that welfare payments constitute, in some sense, reparations. But welfare payments were always structured to assist people who were experiencing poverty. They were never designed to provide people with compensation for the harms and damages that they might have incurred. But also, it's important to note that the welfare system as we used to know it was introduced in the United States in the 1930s during the Great Depression. And the way in which it was introduced was to systematically exclude most black people from being eligible for the benefits. That was done by excluding folks who worked either as farmhands or worked as domestic laborers. And in the 1930s, that was a very, very preponderant set of occupations for black Americans. So not until the mid-1960s were black Americans able to access the benefits of the New Deal. So the so-called handouts associated with the welfare system only went to white Americans for 30 years.
Now, the other argument that I've heard people try to make is that the African-American community has not done what some of the other minority communities have done, which is basically that they've created like their own economic enclaves, whether that's like Chinatown in various parts of society, or whether that's the old version of what was historical Haiti or Tulsa or things of that nature. That we have this economic power.
We did create Greenwood and Tulsa. So I'm not sure what people mean here. Both of those communities were actually destroyed in slightly different ways. Well, maybe substantially different ways. I mean, essentially, the Tulsa community is raised by white violence. Okay. And the Haiti community is essentially destroyed by the bisecting of the community with a highway. And the highway bisection strategy is something that happened in a number of cities throughout the United States. So I think it's really disingenuous for people to say that black folks have not tried to do that and have not been at all successful in doing that. Because when they have been successful, those communities have essentially been leveled to the ground or in some other way prevented from continuing to operate effectively.
And that's what I kind of wanted you to get to and everything, because it seems to me that one of the arguments that I've heard people try to make is that we have this economic wealth, and with this economic power that we have, meaning that the spending power that we have, that we should be doing more with our spending power. But I agree with you that we should be looking at those maybe as models. And I've also heard people say that we can't recreate like a Haiti or a Greenwood or some of those other communities in this modern context. So for those that make that kind of argument that we're not using our spending wealth that we already have, and I know a number of economists have talked about the spending wealth that African Americans have, that what would your argument be to them? Because I have heard people say that, well, you're not using the spending wealth that you have because we're considered one of the top consumers, meaning the African American population.
So this is nonsense, all of it. Every single word of it is nonsense. First of all, we are not the top spenders, at least, not in the aggregate and not per capita. White households on average for a given level of income spend 1.3 times as much as black households on consumption goods. Okay, let me repeat that. White households on average spend 1.3 times as much as black households for a given level of income. There's no significant difference in savings rates between black and white households. And in many income categories, the black savings rate is actually slightly higher than the white rate. And indeed, the fact that white households are able to spend 1.3 times as much as black households is because of the fact that they have much, much higher levels of wealth on average. People frequently say that I've heard this statistic that black Americans have $1.3 trillion in spending power. The total incomes for the black population in the United States is slightly less than $1 trillion. So I'm not sure where the additional $0.3 trillion is going to come from. Unless black people are borrowing $0.3 trillion every year, which is probably impossible given the kind of credit status that we have and discrimination in credit markets. So this is all mysticism. There's no truth to it. The central problem that black Americans are confronted with is not a question of spending stupidly or spending unwisely or not spending within the community. The biggest problem is that black Americans have negligible levels of wealth. And that translates into a very, very small business community, business apparatus. I think what many people don't realize is only 4% of black businesses, and this is prior to the COVID-19 crisis, which seems to have wiped out as many as half of all black businesses. But prior to the COVID-19 crisis, there were only 4% of black businesses that had more than one employee beyond the owner themselves. So black businesses are extremely small. Another way to think about this is if we took all of the black businesses in the United States together, and calculated their retail sales during the course of a year, it would be about one third of the total retail sales of Walmart alone. So the scale of black businesses is negligible, but that's not due to black people's spending decisions. It's due to the fact that we do not have a significant amount of wealth that was transmitted to us across the generations. And that's because we were denied access to the wealth, or the wealth that we accumulated frequently was destroyed.
Well, what are some of the things that surprised you in the book that you wrote with your wife and everything? What are some of the things that you learned that surprised you that you were not expecting? Because I know that there had to be things that you were expecting when you were doing the research, but there had to be things that you were not expecting that surprised you.
I think there were a lot of things that we learned that we weren't aware of. But one of them is the tremendous importance, negative importance, of Andrew Johnson's decision to accommodate the former Confederates, rather than excluding them from the political process under a mechanism that we refer to as lustration, rather than taking the land that they formerly had held and providing it to the formerly enslaved in the form of restitution. So I don't think we fully appreciated the fact that Andrew Johnson probably was the worst president the United States ever had. And we didn't fully understand the extent to which black rights could have been inaugurated and instituted in the immediate months after the Civil War ended. We learned from a traveler named Whitelaw Reed, who had gone throughout the South in the days immediately after the Civil War, that white Southerners expected that that the North would dictate terms, and those terms would include the right to vote for blacks, that those terms would include the provision of some significant tracts of land to blacks, and those terms would include essentially providing blacks with full citizenship in the United States. But as a consequence of Andrew Johnson's temporizing and his bizarre affection for the Confederate leadership, an affection that he never expressed before he became president, because of that, we are in a situation now where there is an unmet debt that has laid unmet for 155 years.
Wow, that's interesting that folks don't think about those kind of things. And some, what were the other things? Like I said, the Andrew Johnson component was one of the things that surprised you. What were some other things that might have surprised you?
I think that we did not know before we did the work about some of the atrocities that were associated with the prison labor or the convict leasing system. One of the most horrific was in a place that's known today as Sugarland, Texas. And we're not the only people who weren't familiar with that. We learned about it in the course of doing our research for this book. But essentially, Sugarland, Texas was a site where a sugar company that was run by two former Confederates relied heavily on extremely low-priced prison leased labor to do the work on their plantation and in their factories for producing processed sugar, and their cruelty and their callousness with respect to the lives of the individuals who they had leased from the convict system was so great that there actually were mass burial sites on the plantation, and some of the conscripted workers were extremely young. There was one report that suggested that one of the youngest convict lease laborers was 7 years of age. There were others that were 10 and 12 years of age. So this really was a horrific case. And what's particularly interesting to us about it is about a year ago, we had a meeting with some students at Duke who were involved in the global health program. And we sat down and we had dinner with them. This is Kirsten Mullen and I. And we asked them where they were from. And these were students who were primarily of East Indian descent. And three of them, sitting at the same tables, all said that they were from Sugar Land, Texas. And so we asked them if they knew anything about the atrocities in Sugar Land, Texas. And of course, they knew nothing about it. And so this is, again, indicative of the fact that we have a repressed or suppressed history in the United States that lays the foundation for the case for reparations, but people are unfamiliar with that case.
Yeah, I think a lot of people aren't familiar with a lot of the things that are out there historically, and you've laid out some of them, but there's just so much of the history that isn't known. And I know some of the things that people don't think about is the ties to the prison industrial complex and how that plays into what you're asking for with reparations as well. So could you explain to the listeners how this prison industrial complex came about and how that is actually tied into even slavery and to kind of this call that we're making for reparations? Because I think a lot of folks may not understand that connection.
So in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, to the extent that Confederates could retain or attain renewed control over the Southern states, they inaugurated a series of regulations, in quotes, that we now refer to as the Black Codes. And those were regulations on Black behavior and Black actions that permitted whites to imprison Blacks very, very easily. And as people have noted, one of the dimensions of the 13th Amendment, which is essentially the amendment that abolishes slavery, is that there's an exception clause. And the exception clause is one that indicates that you can continue the practices of slavery with people who are imprisoned. So essentially what the Black Codes did, both literally and figuratively, they attempted to restore the conditions that existed under slavery without having direct ownership of other human beings on the part of white Americans. And so that's the beginning of this process of creating a system of imprisonment that is connected to the provision of low-wage labor for the individuals who contract with the convict leasing system. And so it dates to the aftermath of the Civil War, but it carries deep into the 20th century.
Wow. And from a historical standpoint, what are some of the historical figures that we know of in our history that might have been supporting reparations? Like I said, I'm not even sure what John Lewis's thoughts were on reparations or even Martin Luther King's or some of the other historical leaders. But what was the impression that you got from some of our historical leaders as to how they felt? And also, do you think, I've heard that there are certain sports figures and certain entertainers that have come to the defense of us getting reparations, and that might be providing a groundswell of support. So I was just wondering if you could speak to that as well.
Well, just as the first abolitionists were the folks who were enslaved, the first reparationists were the folks who were enslaved. But if you want to find a white advocate of reparations early in the game, Thomas Paine had urged that land be provided to folks who had been enslaved, at the same time that he was urging that with the formation of the United States, with the formation of the Republic in the 1770s, that slavery should be ended. However, the Republic was formed with slavery as a fully legal activity in the borders of the United States. And so that's unfortunate, but Thomas Paine represents somebody who was an advocate of reparations. Martin Luther King talked explicitly about the point that I was making a little bit earlier about the fact that the 40-acre land grants were never given to the formerly enslaved, but the Homestead Act gave substantial tracts of land to whites in the United States. And then he talks about some additional benefits that were given to the white landholders who had received the Homestead Acre grants, including the development of land grant colleges and extension services to help them improve their capability to farm the land and the like. And he makes the point that the formerly enslaved got absolutely nothing, and that black Americans have never received restitution. And I think he concludes that commentary by saying, we are coming to Washington, we are coming to get our check. And so I think many people don't really recognize that Martin Luther King was an advocate of reparations also. I guess there's a number of entertainers now who have made overtures about reparations. One of the kind of peculiar examples is the rapper T.I. sending a letter to Lloyd's of London. I mean, this is particularly confusing to me because Lloyd's of London is in the UK, and its connection to reparations primarily must be to the descendants of persons who were enslaved in the Caribbean, not in the United States per se. But yeah, that's an illustration of somebody who is talking about reparations, perhaps in a somewhat confused way, but nevertheless is saying that reparations is something that's appropriate.
And what about those that say and talk about reparations in the sense that this would not be the first time of the United States doing reparations? Because a lot of people will point to the Japanese after World War II or some of the other people that have received reparations in society. So I just wondered if you could speak to the fact that this would not be the first time of America spending money to give somebody the just dues that they deserve. And of course, that was after a World War, and this is something that has gone over centuries. So like I said, I wonder if you just talk about some of the comparison that people try to make about whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, but the reparations has happened before.
Oh yeah, it's definitely happened before. There's some controversy over whether or not it's actually happened for Native Americans, but it's unambiguously the case that Japanese Americans received direct payments from the U.S. government as a consequence of their unjust incarceration during World War II. It's also the case that the families who lost loved ones in the course of the 9/11 attacks have received federal government payments in the form of a reparations project. Excuse me. The families whose kids were killed in the massacre in Sandy Hook, Connecticut, part of the funds that they've received in the form of reparations came from the federal government as well. So there's nothing, there would be nothing unique about the provision of reparations. There would be something unique about its provision for Black American descendants of U.S. slavery, because the country has consistently evaded that responsibility.
And the other argument that I've heard people make, and like I said, I don't buy the argument, but I heard people try to make it, is how would folks not get the reparations that are not part of the African-American descendancies? Because like I said, I do know that even like you talk about the Native American population, that there is sometimes complaint that there are citizens that are white Americans that are not necessarily Native Americans that are receiving some of that federal money because they are able to claim Native American lineage or history. And there's a fear or a concern that there might be some folks that pimp the system, for lack of a better term, and find ways to get the money that is not guaranteed to go to them, that they will be claiming their African-American ancestry because it's the quote unquote trendy thing to do at that time, to those monies be put out there. So I've heard that argument put out there that they're afraid that the system would be corrupted. So I was just wondering how you would address those that make that argument.
So first I want to say, you know, people throw out all these logistical complaints. The first question I want to know is, are they in favor of reparations as a matter of principle? Okay, because we can figure out these logistical problems. And in fact, in our book, we have an answer, a direct answer to those types of concerns. We argue that there have to be two conditions for eligibility for reparations. First is a lineage standard. An individual would have to demonstrate that they had at least one ancestor who was enslaved in the United States. But there's a second condition that also would have to be met. Both of these have to be met. The second condition is what we refer to as an identity standard. And so for at least 12 years before the enactment of a reparations program or before the enactment of a study commission for reparations, whichever comes first, an individual would have to demonstrate that they self-identified as Black, Negro, or African American. So it's those two conditions in conjunction that have to be met. And I think that that wipes out any significant prospect for people chasing the coattails of this and declaring themselves to be Black at the last minute to be able to get reparations, or somebody living white who can identify an ancestor who was enslaved in the United States.
Wow. Just the whole process of creating the book, how did the book come about with you and your wife, and what made you decide that you wanted to write the book? And you alluded to some of the things that you found out in the book that people may not be aware of, but if you share some other facts and figures that you might have learned that you would like to share, I'd love to hear those as well. But just tell folks a little bit about the process of how the book came about. I know you've been an advocate of reparations for a number of years, and some folks are saying that even being more outspoken about your advocacy now. So I'm just wondering if you could just explain a little bit to our listeners about the book process.
So I don't think I've been more outspoken. I've had more opportunities to talk about it lately. And in fact, that's been somewhat amazing. I never expected that there would be that kind of interest in the book and that kind of interest in either Kirsten or myself talking about the book in this way. But I don't think I'm more passionate. I just think that I've had many more platforms recently to actually talk about this. So to be frank, initially I was a reparations skeptic. And I was a skeptic not because I thought it was wrong in principle, but because, like many other folks, I just didn't think it would ever really happen. I didn't think it was politically feasible. But in 1989, I was approached by a researcher named Richard America, who was preparing an edited volume of essays by economists who were attempting to calculate how large the reparations bill might be. And Richard asked me if I would write the introduction to the volume. I'm not sure exactly why he selected me to write the introduction. And I immediately told him that, well, I didn't think I was necessarily the right person because I didn't think reparations was something that could really happen. And Richard said, read the essays, write the introduction, and write it in whatever way you like. I mean, you could write it as a devastating critique of the succeeding essays in the volume. So I agreed. I started reading the essays. And the more that I read, the more that I had a sense that the depth of the harm that has been associated with slavery and with the discrimination that occurred in the aftermath of slavery, that the only real answer to the kinds of economic disparities that Black Americans are experiencing is reparations, and that I should work for it, regardless of how long the odds were against it. The other way I began to think about this is, if it was 1817 in the United States of America, it might look like slavery is something that would never come to an end, but that would not be a reason for not fighting against slavery. In this case, we're fighting for something, which is a debt to be paid that is long, long overdue. But I've been working on this for upwards of 30 years. It was about 10 years ago that I was giving a presentation on reparations, an advocacy presentation on reparations, when I was approached by one of the editors at the University of North Carolina Press, who said, you should do a book on this. And I thought for a moment, yeah, maybe I should. And since Kirsten Mullen is a folklorist and we spent a substantial amount of time together, I was kind of familiar with her point of view, and I thought we could collaborate and produce something that might be really, really strong. And her skills as a folklorist might enable us to tell the kind of stories that would illuminate the premises or the ideas that lie behind the case for reparations. And so that's how we began working on the book. It's a little bit embarrassing to say that it took us 10 years to bring it out, but that's what happened. And I think those 10 years were valuable in terms of the finished product that we have, because it gave us an opportunity to incorporate a lot of material into the book that came to us as new information during the course of us working on the book.
Wow. And one of the other things, I know that you're an economist by trade and by education and things of that nature, but I was just wondering, and just switching a little bit from the reparations discussion and everything, where do you think we are in terms of our current economy? Because I've heard people say that as far as they're concerned, we're in the middle of a recession right now, maybe even depression level numbers, and that for the African American population, we're definitely in a depression. So I was just wondering what your thoughts are as to where we as a people, I mean African American people are, but also where we as a nation are in terms of where we are economically. Because I've also heard people talk about the fact that, you know, people will try to float certain figures that we're in the middle of it, like that the stock market isn't collapsing or that the numbers are going up. So they try to paint it as a pretty picture of where we are. But I don't think that, because I know my personal finances are not that best based on what's going on in the world and the coronavirus and some of the other things that are happening. So I'm just wondering, from an economist standpoint, where do you think we are as a country? And do you see any like good vibes or anything that'll happen in a positive nature, say 6 months down the road? Because I'm kind of almost written off 2020 in terms of like being a successful year.
So I think the numbers are horrifying, actually. We have the highest unemployment rates that the nation has had since the Great Depression itself. As I mentioned a bit earlier, that in the midst of this crisis, it appears that upwards of 50% of Black businesses have gone out of operation. I'm not sure that we'll see the full effects of all of this until we're deep into August or in the beginning of September, when the temporary government income supplements are no longer operative. I think that people have said quite accurately that we're going to witness a wave of evictions because people are not going to be able to meet their rent payments in this circumstance. So many Black Americans disproportionately held jobs that required personal service, personal care, personal contact. And so in many cases, particularly in self-employment like barbershops, beauty parlors, and the like, many of those businesses have been deeply curtailed in their capacity to operate as a consequence of this infectious disease. But to the extent that Black people have retained jobs in the personal care arena, it's because those jobs have been deemed essential, even if the folks holding the jobs are not deemed essential. And in that context, people who continue to hold those essential jobs are in employments where they bear a high risk of contracting the disease. So it's almost as if either you lose your job or you keep a job where you're very likely to get ill. So that's a disastrous set of circumstances from my perspective. Is there any silver lining at all? Well, some people say never let a good crisis go to waste. And I think that the only way we can avoid having this so-called good crisis go to waste is if we actually adopt social policies that would enhance people's lives in the present moment, but also prevent us from having the same kind of disaster if there is a new pandemic or epidemic. And so So, you know, it really is contingent upon our response to the crisis as a nation. And I think we have to do things that are far more dramatic than providing sporadic $600 or $1,200 payments to some households. We need to do something that's much more substantial. I've recommended that the nation adopt a federal job guarantee so that all adult Americans are assured of employment by the public sector in some shape or form at all times and at all moments. And if we had had such an arrangement in place, we would have already had an existing public sector payroll that we could have rolled people into as they lost their jobs. But we can't do that in the absence of such a policy.
And what is your recommendation for those that are thinking about even like minimum wage? Because I'm of the opinion that it's way too low and that it should be higher. So what are your thoughts on that as an economist? Do you think that we should have like a minimum wage that's going to be much higher than it is currently? Because I think that it's at an atrociously low rate from my perspective. But I was just wondering what your thoughts are as to us raising the minimum wage.
So the minimum wage raising the minimum wage is an okay idea. There are two limitations to minimum wage laws. One is if you don't have a job at all, your minimum wage is zero. And then the second problem is minimum wage laws do not set regulations that establish that people will have the requisite number of hours of work to make them eligible for benefits. And so that's why I'm an advocate of a federal job guarantee, where each job would offer at least a wage rate that would be above the poverty line and would offer a benefits package that would be the equivalent of the benefits that are received by federal civil servants. And so what you would do, in effect, was create a floor on compensation, because the private sector couldn't hire anybody unless they at least provided those conditions of work. And so so you would, in effect, establish a minimum wage of sorts, but it would be a more effective minimum wage than one that is legislated as a monetary amount of dollars.
And from an economist standpoint, I know another group of people that have talked about the fact of their disparity and everything is the women of our society, and the fact that there seems to be a very big gap in the amount of the pay that women get versus the amount of pay that men get. And I was just wondering, from your perspective as an economist, what do you see as some of the solutions for that disparity? Because I know there's a lot of talk about that disparity in society as well. So I was just wondering what some of your thoughts were in that regard. Because I have heard that conversation where a lot of people talk about the pay gap that exists between women and between men.
So it's the pay gap between white men and everyone else. Okay. It's the pay gap between white men versus black women, white women, and black men. To the extent that pay gap is attributable to discrimination, then you need to implement anti-discrimination measures. Obviously, a federal job guarantee will help all communities that are subjected to exclusion from employment as a consequence of discrimination. So those are my two solutions. One is full enforcement of anti-discrimination measures, and secondly, implementation of a federal job guarantee.
Well, that sounds like a great idea, and a great idea for folks to have and everything. As we're getting ready to wind down and everything, because I know we've got about 7 minutes to go and everything as we're winding down, but I'm just wondering if you could share with folks how they can get the book. That's one thing that I was going to ask you, and how they can find the book accessible and where platforms are available to find the book. And then the other thing I was going to ask you personally is, how are you dealing with just the virus itself? Like I said, I know a lot of people are doing their work from home and things of that nature. And even in the academic setting, we're going to see more and more of the virtual kind of teaching and things of that nature, even on the college level. So I was just wondering how you personally are dealing with the pandemic that we're in the middle of, and what kind of precautions you're taking. Like you mentioned earlier, you're of a certain age and everything, but I was wondering how you're dealing with it, and also what your feelings are about how colleges and just education in general are going to roll out trying to get people into their academic settings, whether that's high school, whether that's college, whether that's whatever. But I was just wondering how you personally are dealing with it. And then at the end, I'd love to hear how folks can reach you and find out about the book or where they can get the book.
So thank you for asking about how I'm coping and how my family's coping. Thus far, we think we are not ill yet. And we hope to keep it that way. And the primary way we've been trying to cope is by sheltering in place. We're fortunate in my household that the type of work that we do doesn't require us to necessarily leave and go into a physical workspace at all times. And so we have an advantage that way, but that's serendipity. And the other thing I'll say is I'm going to be teaching my classes during the fall semester on an online basis because of concerns about the coronavirus. And then the final thing is with respect to our book can be obtained From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century, can be obtained wherever books are sold. There's been a slight bump in the road because the first print run sold out altogether. And the second print run, which only was released last week, apparently has also sold out. So they've ordered a third print run, which will become available toward the middle of August. But there are still copies that can be obtained from some of the booksellers, including Amazon, Barnes and Nobles, your private booksellers, as well as directly from our press, the University of North Carolina Press. They have copies that can be sold there too.
And I actually feel sorry for those that are in your son's field, and it's a field that I'm also involved with, but definitely folks that are involved in music and entertainment, we know that a lot of their stuff has totally evaporated because they're trying to do virtual concerts and things of that nature, but it's not the same as shows, and a lot of the shows have totally evaporated, even though I do understand some venues that are allowing people to come in at half capacity or quarter capacity or things of that nature, but I know these definitely have had to affect both of your sons in terms of the things that they are doing in terms of their creative endeavors?
Well, my older son is the athletic director at Carolina Friends School. And so to the extent that they've had to cope with the issue of online learning versus classroom learning, that's been something that's had a significant impact on him. My younger son, the musician, Will Darity, who you're referring to, has really had a difficult time as a consequence of concert opportunities and performance opportunities drying up. But I think that he and his fellow musicians are doing their best to create opportunities to share their art virtually. And I think he is recording today for a performance that would take place on behalf of Duke's Music in the Garden series, which is not going to actually take place in the gardens, but they're going to do it online, and I think he's pretty excited about that. And there seem to be more opportunities to do that sort of thing. But yeah, it's a tough time.
Yeah, it's definitely a tough time. And by the way, Ron Thomas, who is a business leader originally from New York, but now lives in Dubai, was actually saying hello to both of us because he was viewing and watching on the screen. But I know he's a business leader that is a friend of my friend, Sri, who is a digital media person out of New York. But he was viewing us and listening to us because he's definitely been a advocate of a lot of things around the country and around the world and things of that nature. One of the questions that I was asked, and then I'm going to wrap this up with the last question, is how can allies of, you mentioned the Indian students, and I know Sri, who is of Indian descent, asked me this on a show that I appeared on, but I would like to hear your view about this. But how do you think that folks that are allies of reparations or allies of Black Lives Matter can best show their allyship and best show their support of what we're trying to accomplish? But in your mind, what is the best way that they can show their support, and how would you urge them to show their support?
So we have organizations, they they work for or that they're part of, I think the first thing one needs to do is get your own house in order, so that to the extent that there are exclusionary practices, discriminatory practices that are taking place in the organizations to which you belong or which you work, that's the first thing that needs to be addressed. And then the second thing is it would be fantastic if Americans across the country who have a sense of allyship on these issues would support, they would petition and lobby the federal government for a comprehensive reparations program for Black American descendants of U.S. slavery.
Thank you. I appreciate you being on. Oh, I said that was the last question, but my last question is, what is your prediction? Because I've heard some people say that they think that Mr. Biden will win. Other people think that the current occupant will unfortunately give us another 4 years of what we've got going on. But what is your prediction for what will happen on the national level? And do you have a pick, or I know it's up to Biden, but do you have a thought as to who you would like to see as the vice presidential candidate, since we know he's going to try to make that pick in the next week or two? And I was just wondering if you had any.
One all together. Mark, thank you so much for having me on.
No problem. Yes, Sam could avoid that question, and I can't avoid it. Can't blame him for avoiding that one. So we'll just find out in another couple of months what happens in that regards. But I do want to thank you, Sandy, for being on, sharing your insight both about the Reparations Project, both about your book and also about the state of the economy that we're in right now. So I definitely want to thank you for being a guest on this special edition of the Online Dinner Party. I've been trying to get you for a while, and either something was happening in my life or something was happening in your life. I know you were having some stuff going on with your personal house, and like I said, we had that the uncle that passed away and everything. So I do want to thank you for finally us getting our times together and us having this time together virtually, if not being able to do it in person. So you're a great relative, a great friend, and I just want to thank you for taking this time with me.
Thank you. Take care.
On that note, we're going to wrap it up on this special edition of the Online Dinner Party. That was a great conversation that we had with Sandy Darity. And as many folks know, he is a leading proponent of reparations around the country and things of that nature. And as I have found out recently, we are related. So it was great having him on here and for us to have this very powerful conversation. So definitely, I am glad that folks were able to pop in and join us on this very special edition of the Online Dinner Party. I told Sandy that I was hoping to get him on at some point or another, because he was definitely one of my wish list folks that I wanted to talk to. And I was glad to have this opportunity to have this conversation with him. If you've got any questions that you would like to know about this show, or if you want to be a guest, or if you've got questions for any future folks that we may have, and we are looking to do some other interviews, there may be another special edition with Representative Zach Hawkins. So we're interested to find out some of his views as well. So do keep in mind and look for that. And of course, we've got our regular edition, The Radio Show with Mark Lee. We'll be back on Monday at our usual time of 2 p.m. I've already lined some guests up for that on Monday afternoon of that particular day. And then, of course, we'll follow that up with Mullins Music and Memories, also with my last name and everything. And that will be on Monday at 4 p.m. And then it'll be the regular edition of the Online Dinner Party on Wednesday at 4 p.m. So we've had some tremendous guests, some tremendous conversations, and we're continuing to build those up. I know that I'm looking forward to a conversation with Jacqueline Dolly. She is a business coach, and I'm looking forward to having a conversation with her in the very near future in one of these shows. And then, of course, we're already talking to other great guests. As a matter of fact, we've got the Parks and Recreation Commissioner of New York City that will be joining us as well on an upcoming edition. So there are some tremendous guests that will be joining us. And, of course, we're always looking for new guests. So bluesradio@gmail.com is how you can reach me, and I'm your host right here on IBM.TV. And I hope that many of you will continue watching these shows and continuing to learn much as we have these very insightful and powerful conversations. So once again, that's going to wrap it up on this particular edition of the Online Dinner Party with Mark Lee. So Once again, I'm going to pop off the screen. Y'all can look at the little dinner party symbol that we've got over there, and then I'll hit end broadcast, and we'll call it quits from there. So hope everybody will keep in tune and join us on an upcoming edition of this program, as well as any special editions that I may put together.